Which you did right there.
Uh-huh.
So now I'm here for about 2 or 3 hours interviewing and taking pictures and all that crap. I said, no. Don't respect that camera whatsoever.
What we want to do is, you know, you've talked to us before, Cheryl, and we understand that you're still trying to get back. There's a lot of people still trying to get back. And you can share those stories with us, and we'll just put it out there for people to understand. Michelle is working in resource economics, and it's one thing to sit in a cubicle, and it's another thing to talk to somebody that's lived the situation. So if you don't mind...
Yeah, sure.
I'm supposed to turn that off.
Yeah, the people who are going to be transcribing this are going to have...
If you don't mind, Carlin will just start asking questions. I may chime in.
Yeah, when you said that, we deal with equipment agency people. Well, you know, they'll come down here and they say, well, this is what you have to do. This is what's needed in the marsh. But they don't know what the hell the marsh looks like. And if they went in New Orleans and they looked at the marsh and they said, this is the way it is, the Chenier Plains totally different than the Delta Plains. It's a different animal altogether. But they say, well, if it fits here, it's going to fit that. And it don't. Mm. And it's so aggravating. We were people were fishing a while back, and the fellow within RCS had to say, will I have to take you and stick your head down in the marsh for you to see? He was trying to explain him what it was, and they could see plain as day what it was. But he was arguing that that wasn't right. You got to almost... it kind of aggravating, but, you know, frustrating for...
Don and I wouldn't know anything about this.
But before we get started, we want to keep the administrators happy. We just want to get you to say on tape that it's okay for us to record interview and to put it at the university in Baton Rouge, in Lafayette, and at National Sea Grant for people to use as a resource in doing research.
I have no problem with that.
Okay.
If the camera can stand it, I can stand it.
I think we can manage.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, we know that. Where's your frustrations? You know,
frustration is that there's a limited amount of funding to start with. And that's too much of the funding falling in the crack before it gets on the ground. And the bureaucracy is, like you know, is slow as hell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they would eliminate half of the bureaucracy, because, you know, you take Clipper, for instance, if you got a project you're going to do and it's approved and all this kind of stuff, and a federal agency takes it, he can only do a certain amount without other agencies looking at it before he can proceed on with it. And at all that time, when that's transpiring, it's taking time, and it's also costing money. Because when that other agency looks at this agency, what he's doing, they're getting part of the pot. So they always tell us, if you can propose a project for $1 million, propose it for $2 million. Double the cost. Well, half of that stuff is just torn to administrative and it's not going on the ground.
So what's been your biggest frustration in getting back into your normal daily economic routine, whether it be cattle or whatever?
Yeah, because the last time we talked to you, I think, was just before I hit.
Mm-hmm.
It was after Rita, but before Ike, and you were getting your herd back together, but we haven't really talked to you since then. So
the main thing right now is cattle. You know, the cattle market is up something terrible.
Yes.
And it's good for sellers. They want the damn to buy. You know, if you want to go buy a herd of cattle, especially after you lost everything to start with, so you're just trying to, you lost all your income. I mean, I lost 150 head of cattle. I lost rice crop for 2 or 3 years. The money that you almost could bank on, but you don't have it anymore. So you got to find a way to try to build up a few dollars to start. And then with the price of beef so high, it's hard to go buy to build your herd back up. About 150 head. Between me and my son, we ain't got about 50 head right now. to start going up.
Mm-hmm. Now, where are you grazing this?
I got a place leased in the woods right here. I can't bring them back where my normal grazing land because I don't have any fresh water.
Still.
Right now, I monitor Schooner Bay and Lehman Bowman locks, which separates the Chenier plane from the Murmantaw from the Tishomingo. Well, it came down, but it was on the inside, was 125 grains. I don't know. I kind of forget how they figured. We use grain per gallon.
Okay.
On the outside was 760. And I'm on the outside. So cattle can take 200 grains per gallon and do all right. It's not good, but they'll do all right. Anything over 200 grains, they start aborting. They diarrhea all the time. They don't do good. That's just like us drinking seawater, you know. Mm-hmm. Full on, you dehydrate, all that kind of stuff. So it's not, you can't really raise cattle. I got all the grass I can save and race over, but they got to have water with that grass.
So that would mean you would have to bring water somehow.
You can dig a well. We have always dug curbing wells, which is, it's kind of funny, and people don't understand that. If you go on Chenier Tig and you dig, you can dig a well 10 feet deep. But you have, a curbing well has to have a lot of body. It's got to be big. But you have to contain it. Like you dig a hole of 60 inches and you put a casing in it, curbing. And then the veins keep furnishing water into that curbing. And you pump out that curbing. Now you get water about maybe 75 grains per gallon. If you go below that, you start getting salt water. Unless you go down 500-600 feet. You got to go below that level of the Gulf of Mexico.
So you're getting
10 feet will get you fresh water.
Well, I said fresh water. It's not water, but it's potable water.
Right.
I mean, we've done that for years. But you can do that. But then, because you don't have electrical power, crank it up and pump the tank full of water, and then a couple of days later, you got to go back and crank it again, fill the tank back up, and you can gravity feed and water the cattle. But if you got any amount of cattle at all, you got to have some hellacious tank.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've got the cattle in the woodland.
Yeah, across the swamp right now.
You talked about the hay. Where are you getting the hay? You said you were growing the hay yourself?
Yeah, we got some hay back here on the farm.
Okay. So you're rolling it and then transporting it to the cattle.
See, I got 150 bales in the shed right there. And then we got 300 on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then we're probably going to bale another 400-500 bales.
Now, will you use all that with your 50 head of cattle, or will you sell
No. My partner, my cousin, and I kind of work together. Mm-hmm. He's got about 100 head. So he uses part of it, and I use part of it. And then we got some neighbors that got a few head of cattle, and they need some hay. So we always bail a few extra, if they need some, or we'll sell them some hay.
But what about your rice land? Can you go back to farming rice now?
Yeah, we can go back now. But we still have spots. And I don't know if I always envisioned that if salt water came on land, and the water evaporated and salt went in the land, you have salt in the land, okay? I always figured water is water, and it's over the whole land. So everything would have salt on it. But we have some spots that we'll plant the rice, and then this part will die. And you check the salinity of the land, it's high right there, and it's not high right here. So I don't know if some parts of the land is more pervious than others, and the salt gets on in them more, or easier or whatever. It might be too hard some places where it doesn't go in the ground, where it goes in softer spots. I don't know. But we still got some places dying.
So normally about how long can you expect it to take for the rain to leach the salt out of the soil?
It took you 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, with a lot of rain. Mm-hmm. The thing we have here is not, if it rains, the water just don't go on. You got to pump it off. It's not gravity drain. Mm-hmm. So that's an extra expense you got. Mm-hmm. You know, after the storm, the LSU Ag said, well, look, why don't y'all flush it? Well, what are we going to flush it with? All the canals with salt water. I mean, they're not going to flush salt out with salt water.
That was actually suggested.
Yeah. Want us to flush it. Well, you know, we're not, I mean, I guess we try to raise rice in the most economical way you can, and that's using surface water. Mm-hmm. So if we don't have aquifer water, oh, we got it, but we're not going to drill wells to do that. And it, right now, it's an act of Congress to get a permit to drill a big water well. And then we don't want to because it's more cost effective to get it off the canal.
Hmm. Now, are you putting any crawfish in your rice fields?
Yeah. I had one done the last 3 years, though.
So this is the first time since those storms that you're doing crawfish?
No, we tried to do it since the storm. Mm-hmm. But your normal, I guess you could say the average of a good crawfish crop is about 700 pounds per acre. That's over the whole crawfish season. I might have got 10 pounds per acre.
No kidding.
Nothing at all. I get 20% of that because my cousin farms the land, so I let him do the fishing and all that kind of stuff. I used to fish myself, but since I got tied up in all these meetings I got to go to, I just don't have the time to do it. And I believe my take this year was $700, which it should have been around $20,000.
Now, does anybody lease your land for alligator? This is alligator season.
I do it myself.
Okay.
I just got through catching my last one the Monday.
How many tags did you have?
I only had 10.
Now, where do you take your alligator when you have to dispose of it?
Well, my cousin. We made a gator farm.
That's Wayne?
Wayne. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not gonna go outside the family.
No. You know, it has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and that's basically what we're trying to do is find out, look for patterns where certain areas are sending their hunts.
Well, I believe probably what y'all looked at some over there today, probably.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. They're probably in pass through him, or it's over with. Mm-hmm. Some kind of way.
Okay.
He's above that bomb. They all process.
Well, we were surprised. We talked to a fellow named the operation was run by a Tommy Stoddard, who we did not meet. It was very fascinating. I think you'd say that. Very fascinating. But they were sending their hides to Singapore mm-hmm. to be processed.
But you see, that's what Wayne does. They either send to Singapore to somewhere in France. Some other foreign country. They go all the time. They go out there all the time, trips over there, getting rid of the alligators and all that kind of stuff.
Now, does he have an alligator farm himself? Mm-hmm. Okay.
He has seven or eight locations. I mean, sheds all over the country. I mean, in this area.
Now, given the hardships that people have faced since 2005, Cheryl, how many people in this area have begun pulling out the traditional economic pursuits, I mean, whether it's ranching, rice farming, or crawfish farming? I mean, are you seeing a lot of people dropping out?
Out of agriculture? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. On our farm, I guess a family farm back here, probably 3,000 acres. There's only about 120 acres planted on it now. And it used to be all planted. It's getting to where, well, in the first place, nobody encourages young people to get into agriculture. Mm-hmm. First place, it costs you a fortune to get into agriculture. If you don't inherit agriculture, you can't get it. Okay, just it's not feasible. It's not cost effective whatsoever. You just can't make a living at it. You got people that, you know, most of the people that lived here. I guess you can say the younger ones, and I kind of consider myself one of the younger ones. Anybody older than me, they all moved out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were retired farmers, but nobody took over when they retired. Mm-hmm. So their land's sitting there idle.
And they're not selling their land. They're keeping the land in their family.
They're keeping it in their family.
But it's either grazed or just sit there.
We got quite a bit of it just sitting there. They're just not doing anything. Now, some of it they're using, they're crawfishing it. But if you don't take the land and you're just going to use it for crawfish, you're basically ruining the land. Because the land doesn't really dry out, you're not working it, you know, and getting rid of the trash and all this kind of stuff. Eventually, all you can have is bull whip and you cut grass and all this kind of stuff. And crawfish don't eat that. So unless you plow the land up, bush hog it, or do something with the land, you're eventually going to just have, it's going to eventually go back to wetlands. And a lot of people want us to do that. myself, the much time and effort we put into building this farm up, I don't want to see it go back to.
How long has your family been cultivating this parcel of land?
Oh, since in the 50s. So they moved from Shinyarte
right
this way, and they started rice farming. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they had cattle on Shinyarte, yeah. And they also had, I know, watermelon. There may have been other things.
And they farmed. My great grandfather was a horticulturist, besides being a medical doc, and he planted just about every kind of fruit tree you could ask for. I mean, he had pears and plums and peaches, and everything. And then they planted row crops, watermelons, cantaloupes, you know, all that stuff. In later years, they started planting produce, you know, butter beans, purple hull, and all this kind of stuff. The island itself, when the people were living there and everything was gone, the hotel was gone and all that, it was a self-sustained community. Well, they'd go to town once a month to buy the staples, whether it be sugar, and flour, coffee, things like that. But the rest of it was, it came from the land. I mean, they lived off the land. They had just about every kind of meat you can ask for.
Now, you also got oysters, you told us at some point, right? Yeah. You used to go. You
used to have an oyster reef, what they call Little Hills, Tiburi, just east of Shinyarte. It was a real nice oyster. You can tell the oyster people tore it down, but they'd go there and get fresh oysters all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the hotel prided itself in fresh seafood. Every day, not every day, but pretty regularly, a couple of times a week, they'd go in with a seine with oxen, big old 600-foot seine, catch shrimp and crabs and you know, everything, and then run to the reef and pick up oysters and come for the people. And for themselves, too, mm-hmm. For the people, the guests they call them.
How old were you when you went on your first cattle drive?
Probably about 12.
And how, remembering now that you've also had grandparents, mm-hmm. How long do you think they've been cattle drives from this part of Louisiana up towards Abbeville, I think? generally that's the way it's gone. Mm-hmm. 100 years? 150 years?
Oh, yeah. In the late 1800s. That was cattle prod. But some of the, I don't know, one of those, I'm trying to find them other articles for you, and I don't know where I put them. I guess the commencement of raising cattle on missionaries and in the marsh. But I can't find it. I'm going to look it up. I'll find it and send it to
you. Well, we're just curious because, you know, at one time, 20 years ago, there were cattle drives that you just stop traffic on bridges.
Well, yeah, well, I remember Miss Amanda invited me to go over and photograph one for her. Mm-hmm. This was, I think, in 86.
Yeah. See, we just did it one time. Because we used to drive to Chenera, too. And we used to, well, before that, we'd barge them.
Barge them?
Yeah. But we left from here and took the route y'all took. All the way to the Freshwater City. Freshwater City wasn't that then. We'd go across the marsh, across old Freshwater Pod, which there's three Freshwater Pods.
And then you follow the ridges?
Well, when as long as we could, but sometimes you had to cut across a pretty bad spot, but then, yeah, we made it. But we drove on from here all the way to Chenera.
Now, the cattle y'all used to run over there. I'm sure you're not using any kind of purebred stock. Tell us a little bit about what kind of stock people used to run.
You want cattle that are, I guess, that the hardiest cows other than Mexican cattle at Brahma cattle. So if you got any kind of mixed breed Brahma, they'd survive with that. They can take the heat. They can take the insects. If you got a purebred cattle, they won't make it at all. They won't get their feed money. Mm. We had a cousin that had some beef master cattle, big old red cow. And he said, well, I'm not going to feed them all winter. I'm going to bring them over now. Them cattle were in worse shape when we took them out in the spring than when we bought them. I mean, they had grass barely deep in the edge of the marsh over there, but they wouldn't get off the ridge to go eat them. Mm. But those Brahma cows are up to their belly in the mud and eating and fat as you can.
Now, the horses y'all used to run, y'all use Creole ponies?
It's a mixed Creole, yeah. Mm-hmm. And big old fancy quarter horses, don't give about that.
Well, tell us a little bit about using those kind of cutting horses with the cattle.
Well,
now it was a smaller than a
it's smaller, a smaller than a, horses. It is smaller horses, and they had bigger hooves. And they'd go in marsh where you couldn't imagine going out at all. And they'd go in a marsh. I mean, a little bit of horses. I mean, if you look at the horses they use nowadays, they'd probably laugh at you if you came up with one of them small horses. But, you know, a lot of people got, over the years, they said, well, Mama, buy me one of these fancy horses. Shit, they walked more than they rode.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The horses just couldn't do it.
Were they hard to handle, the horses?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm curious, too, because I'd heard the Creole ponies were pretty mean.
Well, no. I mean, a horse is a horse is a horse. You know, it's the way how you treat the horse and how you break him and all this kind of makes it either a gentle horse or a crazy horse. You know, it just depends on how you break it and how you train it. You do that. People the same way.
Now, where did you get your saddles?
We got a bunch of us went to Mexico and bought some saddles.
Really?
But there was a man in Guanala, Aubrey Miller. He would make saddles. And we bought saddles from him at one time. Hmm.
We were talking to David Richard.
Oh, yeah, David. That's a character now.
And he was telling us, we'll come back to that, but you're right. He was telling us that on their property, they were getting them out of Anahuac. Apparently there's some cattle. Saddle Maker.
Yeah.
It's really good, yeah.
Yeah, that's, there's several of them somewhere in all central Texas, somewhere up in that makes that.
Now, how many people would it take to drive your family's herd? How many people would go out to?
Well, it would range in from 10 to 20, in, you know, in that neighborhood. You don't need too many. As long as you got cattle, and I'll give you an example. Like, we used to bring cattle here in the summertime and then bring them out there in the wintertime. And we had to patrol the fences when they got in the fall of the year so they wouldn't get in the rice fields. They'd walk up and down that fence. They knew it was time to go back to the barn. And if you got some lead cows, and you got a rider in the front or a couple of riders in the front, they'll follow that horse until you get back. And it's, they know it. They know it's getting that time of year, and it's time to go home. And they follow them. We'd put them on barges. We'd put 100 head at a time on a boat. And go open a gate, turn them up.
Now, how did you push them by barge? Did you go down? What waterway did you go down?
Well, you use, before all the canals would dug, we'd go around through Vermilion Bay to, and then come back around to the Gulf and let them by and we'd bring them to the farm. But in my time, we always did have the deep bayou, which is go through the Vermilion Bay and go through the Audubon. And they got a straight canal that goes straight to St. Tee.
Yeah.
That's what the route we take.
So you crossed Audubon Refuge?
Yeah.
Oh, that was nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got right away for perpetuity through Audubon.
Okay. All right. Now, and there's just a small amount of cattle on Chinaroo Teak now?
I guess counting the calves is about 9-10 head.
That's all. Now, does your family own the entire Chenier, or you share ownership with the McElhaney's or somebody like that?
Well, the McElhaney's on the west end of the island, the far west end of the island.
I got it.
The west end of the island and then going back towards Freshwater Bar.
Okay.
They're just on the little end of the island. Now, they got some other families that own some land, little tracts.
Okay.
10 acres, 15 acres, 20 acres, you know, little strips here and there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I guess the bulk of it is owned by the family.
Okay. All right. Clarifies. Now, did your family ever get involved in the oyster business?
No.
Always been, for lack of a term, let's just call it agriculture.
Right.
But, okay, not aquaculture.
When you set out to do the cattle drives, would you take along with you? Obviously, you have your horse and saddle. What else did you take?
About as much booze as you could drink. I mean, I gotta be honest.
Hey, that's what we want.
Well, you run the town, and you used to be able to buy salt meat in chops, like pork chop, and salt meat. Well, you'd boil that up with some fresh potatoes and all that stuff, put that in the saddlebag with your fifth of whiskey on the other side, and you're just going. You get hungry, reaching in, and eat, and just keep on going. I mean, it wasn't like on television where you have to camp out at night and all this kind of stuff. You made it in a day.
Mm-hmm. A long day.
Yes. When the sun's just coming up, you on the horse, you're running, you're going. And when you get over there, the sun is going down. It took a while.
So what was the routine? When did you take them to the Chenier, and when did you bring them back?
You usually bring them in at least before the 1st of June.
Mm-hmm.
And in November, you bring them back.
Now, y'all had somebody who stayed out there with them, or you just went to check on them periodically? Or?
One thing about, you know, and I keep telling the younger generation that it's an animal. The good Lord made that thing to go and eat grass and drink water and produce calves. You ain't got to play with them all the time.